From KCUR News, this is Casey Currents, reporting news and culture in Kansas City's diverse communities and beyond. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. On this week's show, how the U.S. agricultural industry is supporting and feeding the world.
Agricultural productivity is 2 to 4 times as effective as any other productivity in alleviating poverty.
Plus, the United States Postal Service is cutting hours in parts of rural Missouri.
If it's shut down of a morning, that's when I do most of my running around, is early morning hours.
And how a local artist helps solve crimes and mysteries with her drawings.
Everybody thinks, oh, I couldn't describe my own mother. Well, you probably couldn't, but when you compare it to pictures, you know when it's right and you know when it's not right.
And find out what parts of Kansas looked like 100 years ago.
In the little county historical societies that occur in every county, they've got great photos, images that don't appear anywhere else.
Listen up for Casey Currents just after this hour's news. This is Casey Currents. I'm Suzanne Hogan.
And I'm Susan Wilson. Casey Currents is KCUR's weekly magazine show. We use voices, stories, and sound to take you to neighborhoods around the region.
2 weeks ago, Missouri Republican candidates were trounced in the statewide races. In fact, out of the 6 races at statewide level, only one Republican candidate came out on top. That was incumbent Lieutenant Governor Peter Kinder. In what many consider to be an increasingly red state, how did the Republican Party lose? St. Louis Public Radio and Beyond November's Chris McDaniel takes a look.
A week after the conservative losses at the polls, about 20 Tea Partiers gathered at a restaurant in North St. Louis County to listen to lecturers talk about a few ideas for the future, the flat tax and the fair tax, and yes, to commiserate about the recent past.
How, if we can't even elect a Republican president, with Barack Obama as his opponent,
exactly,
how in God's name do you sell, we're going to eliminate the tax code?
Bill Hennessy helped found the St. Louis Tea Party. He didn't spend much time talking numbers from the election. Instead, he talked about how to move forward. If he had talked about the past more, he would have had to talk about how the statewide races weren't even close. The average Democratic win was nearly 10 percentage points. And this was with the Republican presidential candidate carrying the state by a large margin. And this was with the Republicans gaining an historic amount of power in the state legislature, where the party has a veto-proof majority in both the House and the Senate. So how did this happen? How did a party that was so seemingly set up to succeed fail at the statewide level? St. Louis University political scientist Ken Warren says Republicans have to make a change.
It's just impossible to win if you're turning off women, minorities, and young voters.
Warren points to exit polls that show the Republican Party did a poor job of courting those demographics. Warren says part of the blame for the loss should fall on Tea Party groups and the religious right. Tea parties and the religious right were fundamental in getting Congressman Todd Akin on the ticket. Akin's now infamous comments concerning the biology of rape, which is believed in some firmly conservative groups, hurt the Republican Party, according to Warren.
The Republican Party really does not represent that extremism, but they can't help but be associated with it.
It's not only political scientists that are saying the Republican Party needs to change.
We've certainly blown it.
That's former Senator John Danforth. He was instrumental in shaping the Missouri Republican Party 30 years ago. He says his party should have a majority in the U.S. Senate.
Why don't we? Well, we've nominated people like Todd Akin and Richard Murdoch and people who, if they had been good candidates, should have won elections. But they were kind of far out, and I think they were viewed by their constituents as being far out and unelectable, and they weren't elected.
Danforth says, quote, off-the-wall candidates like Akin damaged the Republican brand. Akin has said there should be no exception for abortion or emergency contraception, even in instances of rape. But Danforth, who is an ordained Episcopal minister, says Republicans have to step back from social issues.
The social issues have pretty much run their course, and that they tend to be extremely divisive and probably not very consequential.
But the prospect of moderating viewpoints on social issues isn't an argument that many in the Republican Party will be ready to hear. Kathy Wimmer was at the St. Louis Tea Party meeting after the election.
No, the farther we go and the more we try to bring it and change who we are, the more diluted we'll become, the less we'll win.
Wimmer says Danforth went off the reservation. She calls him a rhino, a term used in Tea Party circles to refer to Republicans that aren't conservative enough. It stands for a Republican in name only. But Danforth says conservatives have to get away from statements like that. He says Republicans have to unite behind fiscal conservatism, which he says resonates with a lot of voters. I asked everyone I interviewed whether or not they thought the Republican Party would change for 2016. Wimmer, the Tea Partier, says the GOP better not abandon its conservative base. Danforth told me he hopes so. And political scientist Ken Warren, he says the Republican Party doesn't have a choice.
You better move to the center or you're going to have a bleak future.
That report was from St. Louis Public Radio's Chris McDaniel. The United States is the world's leading corn producer and exporter, supporting the increasing demand for meat in China, India, and other countries with growing middle classes. Those countries import livestock feed made from Midwestern grain. But as Amy Mayer reports for Harvest Public Media, feeding the world takes more than shipping protein overseas.
It's the holiday season, so you'll probably soon be hearing this 1980s pop song, which accompanied hunger relief efforts. The United States has a history of food aid, and Midwest grain certainly has its role. But sending corn, soybeans, and other food abroad is just part of the equation when it comes to figuring out how we'll feed the 9 billion people projected to be on the Earth in 2050. World Food Prize laureate and former international aid worker Catherine Bertini applauds bipartisan efforts that have refocused American food policy on farming. She spoke recently at the University of Nebraska-Lincoln.
The administration now, for the first time in a long time, decided, yes, it's a good idea to put more effort into agriculture development.
That means helping all farmers succeed, not just distributing food to the hungry. Governments, nonprofits, and private businesses all have a place in the effort. Seed companies, for example, are developing technologies specific to regions all over the globe. Mike Vandelaar, the chief operating officer of Winfield, a Land O'Lakes subsidiary, says advances in seed technology can have global impact, and the biggest players know to innovate locally, wherever that is.
Generally, the most productive genetics are the ones that are developed within the area where the plant breeding has been done.
If your target market is China, he says, set up a lab there. And eventually, the technology will help Chinese farmers increase yield. Bertini says the U.S. government's Feed the Future program, a commitment to help ensure the world has enough to eat, emphasizes local food production. In places where people are hungry, the program supports small farming efforts because those have a ripple effect.
The World Bank says that agricultural productivity is 2 to 4 times as effective as any other productivity in alleviating poverty.
Today, the world's growing population relies on a combination of international trade, food aid from the rich countries to the poor as needed, and increased local production.
I have two high tunnels, and we use one of them for tomatoes and then the other one for cucumbers.
We need to produce as much to feed the world as we can, but also people like to eat local, locally grown foods too. So there's a case for both sides of agriculture.
That's Boone County, Iowa farmer Greg Reinhart. This greenhouse-like high tunnel extends the growing season for some of the vegetables and fruit his family grows on 100 acres and sells at farmers markets. But on 700 acres, they grow traditional row crops.
Once we sell it, though, we don't actually know exactly where it's going, but we know it's not being wasted. It's being used somewhere in the food chain, whether in the United States or it's being exported to many countries in the world.
Given the rich soil and well-developed infrastructure here, Midwestern farmers are likely to continue playing an important role on the world food scene. But Iowa State University economist Bruce Babcock says the goal of domestic production around the world isn't as far off as many people seem to think.
The overwhelming supply of calories and food that is consumed in most countries comes from the country that is the consuming country.
So the persistent challenge is distribution. And even rich countries haven't figured out how to get food to everyone who needs it. I'm Amy Mayer, Harvest Public Media.
And while the U.S. remains the world's biggest supplier of corn, this year American farmers will lose a portion of that global corn market. That's due largely to the drought, which led to higher corn prices and a shortfall, leading the USDA to predict that corn exports will be at a 40-year low. As Abby Fentress-Swanson reports, that means it's a tough time to be an American grain exporter.
Each American farm worker feeds more people than any other farmer on earth.
That's a clip from a 1960s USDA video called Miracles from Agriculture, which touts the success of the American farmer. Even back then, before the combine, American farmers were producing more corn than any country in the world, 275 million bushels a year. Now U.S. exports top more than 1 billion bushels a year.
Just step around that all together so you don't have a wet foot.
Just south of St. Louis on the Mississippi River, Tyler Banneke, the burly first mate of a towboat called the R. Clayton McWhorter, is clearing ice off the top of a 200-foot-long steel container covered with a white fiberglass top. It's a grain barge and one of 20 barges that his crew will push down to the Gulf of Mexico. There, it will be loaded onto a ship that sets sail for Asia. Banneke opens the barge's hatch.
I'll open this one up here.
Whoa. That's corn.
It's about even to the top of the combing rails on this barge, so you figure there's at least 13 feet of product straight down from the surface here. Give you kind of an idea. And then it's about 30 feet wide, so.
But there are many fewer barges making the trip this year. The Upper Mississippi usually transports more than half of the country's grain exports, and in normal years has grain barge traffic jams. Farmers with corn to sell are getting more than $7 a bushel domestically, so they don't need corn exporters like Rick Dusek, who works for the big grain exporter CHS Incorporated.
Well, normally we'd originate all the corn that needs to be loaded at the Center Gulf along the river system, meaning the Mississippi, the Illinois, the Ohio, all the way down to the Gulf, and this year they're just simply isn't enough corn to supply the export pipeline out of those areas, so we've got to bring corn from the outside.
CHS isn't the only exporter buying corn from foreign countries like Brazil, Argentina, and Ukraine.
In South America, you know, we have a presence where we can buy and store grain as well as process it in Europe, in Eastern Europe, and Australia.
Mark Klein works for ag giant Cargill.
And so, you know, as a team, we all work together to keep track of, you know, where there are adequate supplies, you know, where there are deficits, and then working with our customers to try to get them the products that they need when they need it.
But most U.S. exporters don't have such a global reach. While the Omaha, Nebraska-based Schooler Company is able to buy some corn from other countries, Bob Luddington in the company's Overland Park, Kansas office says the drought is still hurting their bottom line.
Our forecast is to be down slightly from the past several years, and that's really due to our elevators where we will handle less grain due to the drought.
Luddington says they'll eventually find the corn they need to fill their orders, but it will be more expensive and take them more time and effort. The company is now hoping for a bumper domestic crop next year.
Yeah, next year our problem will be where we're going to put it all. That's what we hope. Where we're going to put it all, we'll be scraping off dirt to be able to pile grain on the ground. That's what we're all hoping for, too.
Pat Westhoff with the Food and Agricultural Policy Research Institute says even with a good crop next year, customers could get used to buying corn elsewhere. Until this year, the U.S. was the only exporter China went to. Now it's doing business with Argentina and Ukraine.
When we see these shifts in export patterns occurring, it means that we've lost some market share in the near term. If that creates new habits of users around the world, it could mean lower market shares for the U.S. in the future.
But those trading patterns will be dependent on future corn harvests and yields around the world. Since globally the amount of grain in storage is smaller than it's been in years past, exporters will be watching the yields and prices for the next big corn crop coming in, South America's corn crop early next year. Abby Fentress-Swanson, Harvest Public Media.
Harvest Public Media is a collaboration between KCUR and public media stations across the Midwest. For more information, go to harvestpublicmedia.org.
Just ahead, a local artist who can make a recognizable face come to shape using memories. This is Casey Currents.
This is Casey Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.
The United States Postal Service is moving ahead to reduce the hours of thousands of post offices across the United States. KSMU's Jennifer Davidson has this reaction from a rural Ozarks community.
Right now, I'm standing outside the front door of the tiny post office in Pomona, Missouri. It's a very small, white, plaster, concrete building. Pomona is in a rural part of south central Missouri. This is one of the many post offices across the United States, most of them in rural areas, that is slated to significantly reduce its hours in an effort to save money by the U.S. Postal Service.
I think all of the smaller offices in this area, they're all going to that because of, you know, there's a lot of lag time.
Anna Carnifix is the postmaster relief for the Pomona office, and she's right. Scores of very small post offices in the rural Ozarks are reducing their hours, too. Taneyville, Spokane, Niangua, Rockbridge, Walnut Grove, Washburn. The nationwide list is about 4,000 offices long. But Carnifix says in the Pomona office, there will be little impact on customers.
Nothing is changing as far as what they can expect out of the post office other than the hours.
The U.S. Postal Service originally floated the idea of closing thousands of rural post offices to save money, but rural America and its representatives in Congress roared back, prompting the USPS to unveil this new savings plan of reduced hours. Now, it's sending out surveys and holding community town hall meetings to get feedback. Pomona's post office had its town hall meeting a few weeks ago, Carnifix said.
We had a full house. This was stuffed. That room out there was full. And we had a very good attendance of people.
On January 26th, this post office will go from being open 8 hours a weekday to 4 hours. It will be closed in the mornings. And about a mile down the country highway is the home of Cleta Collins. It's her job to mail the cards from her Sunday school class in the Pomona Christian Church.
I buy all the stamps and make sure that they get mailed and all of that. So if it's shut down of a morning, that's when I do most of my running around is early morning hours.
In the afternoons, when the post office will be open, Collins says she's usually busy sewing or quilting with the ladies' aid at her church. She says the financial situation of the Postal Service is on the minds of her friends and neighbors. Richard Watkins is a spokesman for the USPS based in Kansas City.
It's important so that the Postal Service can not only maintain its presence in thousands of mostly rural communities nationwide, but that we can also look at saving some significant money going forward.
Watkins says the majority of post offices having to reduce their hours are in rural areas because they don't get much traffic.
We know how much revenue comes into our post offices, and that's important, again, because we're not tax supported, but we also know how many retail transactions are being made each day. And at some locations, we were, in effect, paying a postmaster to be on call, if you will, to sell a handful of stamps each day.
The USPS is giving these low-traffic communities four options: to keep their offices open with reduced hours, to close the offices but keep mail routes, to close the offices but use an alternative retail spot like a grocery store, or to just close it and use another post office. Most communities, Watkins says, have chosen option one. The U.S. Postal Service is not tax-supported, and Watkins says it wants to keep it so. But the way Americans send mail is ever-changing, and the Postal Service is scrambling to adapt. When the Post Office Structure Plan, or POST Plan, is fully implemented in September of 2014, the U.S. Postal Service says it expects to save about $500 million a year. The Postal Service ended the 2012 fiscal year with a record net loss of $15.9 billion. That's according to a release from the USPS. It's asking Congress to waive its pre-funded retirement benefits and to have more flexibility in running its operation. For KSMU News, I'm Jennifer Davidson.
If you missed part of Casey Currents today, you can catch individual stories or hear the whole show online at kcur.org, and we've got a podcast. Find us on iTunes.
You've probably seen crime shows like CSI and America's Most Wanted, where artists work with victims to get a drawing that helps identify a criminal. This job is performed by a forensic illustrator. If you've seen one of those drawings on the news in Kansas City, then you've seen the work of artist and author Lee Hammond, who lives in Overland Park. As part of our Odd Job series, KC Currents' Suzanne Hogan met up with Lee to look at how using memories, the face of a suspect or victim can come to shape.
A day can change quickly for artist Lee Hammond. She's been working on call for the Kansas City Police Department for over 30 years. She says you never know when you'll get the call to come in and help solve a case.
I take my little bag here that's got my drawing pencils and the things that I use for shading and erasers, and you know, I'll show up immediately.
Using these tools and facial identification books, which are filled with pages of examples of different physical characteristics, Lee sits down with victims or witnesses to try to turn a memory into a composite drawing.
Everybody thinks, oh, I couldn't describe my own mother. Well, you probably couldn't, but when you compare it to pictures, you know when it's right and you know when it's not right. And so through process of elimination, it almost gets exciting and fun, and they kind of forget what they went through, and it's like a whole different situation.
Lee's been doing this for a long time, and she says there's one major common misconception about this line of work.
People don't really understand what a composite is. They want it to be a portrait, and when they see the drawing and they see the mugshot of the person we've apprehended, you know, if it doesn't look identical to the guy, they think it wasn't a good composite.
A composite drawing is supposed to represent a grouping of facial characteristics to create a category that helps police officers narrow a search. Now, working as a forensic artist is only one small part of what Lee does for work. Inside her home studio in Overland Park, she works as an art teacher nearly every day of the week. Today, four women are chatting and working on paintings of their grandchildren or forest landscapes. It's a stark contrast from a crime investigation.
Oh, that was so much fun.
She shows student Susan Sinclair how to use a sponge to add details to a tree trunk.
Gives you texture without it.
Sinclair is a freelance artist for Hallmark and has been coming here for classes for over 10 years. But when she first signed up, she didn't know that Lee was painting more than animals, flowers, and celebrity portraits.
I didn't know about any of her other careers. Or the fact that she was in America's Most Wanted.
Lee's drawings have played a major role in solving local and national cases, much like some sort of superhero. She can transform quickly to answer the call.
I can feel myself changing from the person I am in this room that's kind of goofy and all over the place and having fun with my students. And I get called and I get in the car and I can feel this change coming up over me where I'm straightening up and I'm getting more firm. And by the time I park my car and I walk in that police department, I'm a different person. So I morph into this forensic investigator, if you will.
Art has always been a part of Lee's life, but before she was an art teacher or did forensic art, she had hopes of going into law enforcement. She worked the late night shift for the Lincoln Police Department and was preparing for the academy. Sometimes she would bring in outside art projects to help pass the time during the long, boring shifts. Other officers there were also super bored, and while watching Lee draw, they decided to make up a game.
They would come in and they would pick out the ugliest people they could find out of their mug files and try to describe them to me. For some reason, it came easy to me, and I was like spot on, and it became, you know, draw the ugly mug shot every night.
And the practice from this game paid off in a very real way. One day, the day lieutenant called her in to do a composite for an abduction case.
I was just freaking out. I didn't know what to do.
But they figured Lee giving it a try was better than nothing, so she had a go at it.
I worked with her for about 5 hours, and we got a drawing. And the very next day, we apprehended him because the drawing looked so much like him that his own wife turned him in, saw the picture in the paper, and turned him in.
From that point on, they decided not to send Lee to the academy, but instead to Smith & Wesson forensic training. There, she learned about the facial anatomy of different races, interview techniques, how to make sketches after a body has started to decompose, age progression, and some psychology. It's a combination of art skills and people skills. Building a rapport is key to the process.
Especially with rape cases, or especially women, they're a lot more at ease with me than some, you know, 6'5" burly cop that's sitting there, you know, doing the interview. So they'll tell me things that they wouldn't tell someone like that.
Lee steps aside from the art class to show me a portfolio of drawings that represent cases she's been a part of.
This was a gentleman that was found dead floating in a creek, and no one could identify him. Well, there's the Alley Camp murder. This was Precious Doe. Do you remember Precious Doe?
Precious Doe, the pseudonym assigned to the unidentified body of a young girl who was found decapitated in Kansas City about 10 years ago. The case shocked the community with its brutality. Now, you can't put somebody's death photo on the news to identify them, so Lee worked with law enforcement to create a rendering of Doe so that the community could help in identifying her and find her killer. But the case took a toll on Lee.
I worked on Precious Doe for probably a week, and I remember my son, he said that after he'd gone to bed, if he got up, he could see my light on down in the living room, and he could hear me crying because it was that disturbing. And I never really got over that one.
Like any profession that deals with violence and trauma, it can have its emotional challenges in hand with the technical. With more and more departments using computer programs, finding someone like Lee who does composites by hand is becoming more rare. She says computer programs are better than nothing, but still believes that a personal, hands-on approach leads to more accurate results, which make the job that much more rewarding. Lee's accuracy record for identifying victims and suspects in cases is 100%. For KCUR News, I'm Suzanne Hogan.
You can see a slideshow of composite drawings from forensic artist, teacher, and author Lee Hammond on our website at kcur.org. This story is part of KC Current's Odd Job series. If you know somebody with an odd job, we'd like to know about it. So send us an email at kccurrents@kcur.org. Coming up, a look at what Kansas looked like 100 years ago. This is KC Currents. This is KC Currents. I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan. In area news this week, the city council cracked down on party houses. Talks between Hostess Brands and the Bakers Union failed again, and the holiday season got underway with a Kansas City tradition. Steve Bell recaps on those and other top stories of the week in the Weekend News Review.
Sixty-degree weather brought out an even larger crowd than usual for the annual Plaza lighting ceremony, and 11 Plaza stores were open so celebrants could get an early start on Black Friday. Friday shopping crowds were large. A nationwide protest over pay and benefits turned out demonstrators at some Walmart stores, but the stores were fully staffed and shopping unobstructed. Kansas City's City Council cracked down on after-hours party houses. Councilman Scott Wagner said until now it was very difficult for police to do anything about them, even the ones that were selling liquor without a license.
They would have to be invited in. They would have to be able to make a buy of alcohol or drugs in that place, identify all the people that they came into contact with, then get a warrant to then go back in, identify the same people, and actually make an arrest at that point.
Wagner says the new law changes that.
Through this ordinance, we have an ability for immediate action because if the police department comes up and they see a crowd, which in some cases can be 100, 150, 200 people at a single residence, they can then order that dispersal.
Consequences under the new ordinance can also include fines up to $1,000 and jail time. The council also took step two in its effort to bring ambulance response times back within goals established before new 911 screening protocols were introduced. The council expanded the board that advises the ambulance service, adding another council member and an emergency medical physician not affiliated with the ambulance service. Ed Ford sponsored the plan.
I think this will give us a more balanced committee than what we have now, which is dominated by the fire department.
Since the changes in dispatching, only about 63% of ambulance responses were meeting the 9-minute or under goal. After what looked like a reprieve, about 200 Hostess Brands employees in Lenexa got layoff notices, most of them immediate, after last-minute mediation with the Bakers Union hit impasse. Hostess will liquidate.
Chris Kobach offered a critical rebuttal of college students who picketed his office, charging that his controversial immigration law work for other states was taking time from his duties as Kansas Secretary of State.
Evidently, they want me to set aside the Secretary of State's duties and talk immigration policy, and I draw a very clear line between what I do as Secretary of State and what I do regarding trying to stop illegal immigration.
Kobach also proclaimed the Kansas voter photo ID law a success, saying the new law resulted in only 717 provisional ballots out of more than a million. He didn't comment on the outcomes of those challenges. Wrapping up the week, a lawyer who tweeted negative comments about Phil Klein during his Kansas Supreme Court hearing on ethics charges against him was fired from her job as a research attorney for the state. Sarah Peterson may end up facing ethics charges herself. And three men and a woman were charged with the execution-style killing of three persons and the wounding of a fourth in Independence last week. Police say the killers thought they would find money and drugs at the house they invaded. This is KCUR.
The Friday after Thanksgiving has become known as National Day of Listening, a day set aside to encourage people to grab a loved one, colleague, or mentor, a microphone, and record and conduct an interview.
National Day of Listening is a project of StoryCorps, an independent nonprofit whose mission is to provide Americans of all backgrounds and beliefs with the opportunity to share and preserve the stories of our lives. Michelle Skaleski of KSMU in St. Louis talked with StoryCorps founder David Isay about the project.
When you started StoryCorps in 2003, what were your hopes for it?
Well, I mean, StoryCorps was started as this kind of crazy experiment. You know, we launched this booth in Grand Central Terminal where families can come to interview one another about their lives with the help of a trained facilitator. So I didn't know what was going to happen, to be perfectly honest. I mean, I had a hunch that it could work, but I certainly had lots of fears about things going wrong in the booth and kind of Jerry Springer moments and all kinds of awful things happening. But from the first day that we opened, I've been really amazed and moved by the impact that these simple conversations has on people. And it's worked in ways I never could have imagined. You know, I used to make radio documentaries for public radio, and about 9 months after starting StoryCorps, I decided to retire from that job to devote the rest of my life to attempting to grow StoryCorps into a sustaining, you know, American institution, which is what I will devote the rest of my life to doing. So every moment of the last 9 years has been a surprise and a happy surprise with StoryCorps. We've now done about close to 50,000 interviews with about 100,000 people across the country, and each day I'm more convinced of the power of this simple process.
I think what people like about it is it gives ordinary people a voice. Is that kind of what you had in mind when you started it?
Absolutely. You know, it's very much a project about everyday people. And, you know, I remember the great oral historian Studs Terkel cut the ribbon on our booth when we launched in Grand Central Terminal. He's since passed away, and I think he was in his 90s at the time when he came to New York from Chicago, and he cut the ribbon and said, you know, we know who the architect of Grand Central Terminal was, but, you know, who laid these floors, who built these walls? Those are the stories you must collect in the years to come, and, you know, we've worked body, soul, and, you know, kind of every cell of our energy to live up to that mandate he threw down. You know, I think it's about the fact that everyday people are talking. It's about the fact that, you know, in some ways it's the polar opposite of reality TV. Nobody comes to StoryCorps to get rich. Nobody comes to get famous. It's a simple act of generosity between two people. And, you know, one of the powers of radio is that you can tell when someone's being authentic and when someone's not. You know, that's the human voice. And when you hear these StoryCorps interviews, you know, people are just being generous, kind, and real with one another. And that's the power, I think, of the broadcast side of StoryCorps.
There may be some people who are a little bit reluctant to interview someone just because they're not sure how to get started. Just to let everyone know, your website has lots of great advice. What is your web address? And just talk a little bit about what some of that advice is.
Sure. Well, we have two websites. One is StoryCorps.org, and that will lead you directly to the website that has the do-it-yourself instructions, which is NationalDayOfListening.org. And I guess there's two sides to it. One is anxiety about doing the interview itself. You know, you just want to dive in and do it. The facilitators who are in the booth for the who've been in the booth for the 50,000 interviews that we've done will always tell participants that just to ask that question that they really want to ask at the beginning of the 40-minute session, because the sessions go by so fast. So what you want to do is you want to prepare questions. And on our website, we have something called a question generator that has the 10 most frequently asked questions and then hundreds of others. Ask questions you want to ask. And, you know, I think that the biggest impediment to doing this is just taking the time to do it. And you just want to kind of dive in and ask that person who you want to do the interview to do the interview. And odds are they're going to say yes, because everybody wants to be listened to. You know, on the other side, you've got the family member who's like, I don't have any story to tell. And, you know, those are invariably the people who, after the 40-minute interview, you have to kind of drag them out of the booth by their ears. You don't want to force people to do a StoryCorps interview. But as I said a moment ago, I mean, most people do want to be heard. And if it's, say, your parent, and they're not responding to your request to do an interview, you might want to say, look, this isn't for you, this isn't for me, this is for our grandkids, our great-grandkids. And that will often kind of explain to people why they're doing this. Another thing you may want to do is ask if there's a grandkid that might have an easier time with the grandparent than you doing the interview with your parent, have your kid do the interview. And that can sometimes kind of melt those barriers down. But again, if someone really doesn't want to do it, you just don't do it. But the vast, vast majority of people do want to participate.
StoryCorps has permanent booths in New York City, Atlanta, and San Francisco, and mobile buses that travel the country, allowing people to record interviews that are archived at the American Folklife Center at the Library of Congress. Since it started in 2003, more than 50,000 interviews have been recorded with more than 100,000 participants. A link to the StoryCorps project is on our website at kcur.org.
It's always cool to see a photo of a place in your town side by side with a photo of that spot 100 years ago or more. That's the concept behind Then and Now books. Monroe Dodd's Kansas Then and Now is his fourth in this genre. The others focused on the Kansas City area. The book features historical scenes from Kansas plains and prairies, taking us back to the time that the state was still a territory. Susan sat down with Monroe a couple months ago to talk about the book. She asked him what came first, the photos from then or now?
What came first was a notion of what do we need to do to depict Kansas over time? We know we got to get some pictures of something having to do with grain and something having to do with cattle, something having to do with mineral extraction, the various industries of the state, certainly railroads. It'd be nice to have old west towns because that's part of the look of the thing, old military days, street scenes and other stuff. That came first, then the finding of the photos. Kansas has a rich photo collections, not only in the State Historical Society archives and at places like KU and Wichita State, but also in the little county historical societies that occur in every county. They've got great photos, images that don't appear anywhere else. The locals knew exactly, understood right away what we wanted, which was, we'd like a great picture from your town or this area that evokes an interesting moment or that represents an era in history, something that if we took it today, it would be like traveling through time. They got that notion and they came up with photos for us.
So how long did it take you to get all the photos finished?
We worked about 4 or 5 months traveling to various parts of Kansas and collecting now photos to match the then photos. We were lucky because this was such a mild winter. Driving was easy. It wasn't too cold and there was no snow to block the views.
How did you know that when you saw the then shot, that when you did the now shot, you were standing in the right place? That look, as I looked at the pictures, I thought, that might really be challenging.
It was challenging on a lot of occasions. If a structure is still standing in the same place as it was 100 years ago, The 100-year-ago structure often had lots of little details and things you can line up the perspective with. But in so many instances, for instance, the Board of Trade building from 1876 right here in Kansas City, right by state line, if you go to that spot today, nothing is the same as it was then. The building has been erased. The stockyards are gone. The street has come in where there used to be just a rail track. It was very difficult to line that up. And we wound up actually pacing it, the distance and the direction from the current Board of Trade building, because you can find old maps that show you where the one we're looking for was and where the current one is. And I paced it off, walking through the building and walking out into the street and through a parking garage and over, figuring there, that's probably where the photographer stood. It's very difficult. Well, it's impossible to know exactly where the photographer stood. I need to mention here that my wife, Jean, took most of the pictures on the project. I held up a computer screen or a printout or something, and often had to fend off traffic or warn her of oncoming traffic while she took the photos. I took the captions. Between us, we came up with the old pictures.
Let's start with one of your picks and my picks, the Lawrence pictures. Let's talk about those. Lawrence was a community, and I didn't even know this, that kept bouncing back from destruction.
That's right. Its a city symbol is the phoenix rising from the ashes. The picture we have in the book is from 1863, and it shows Massachusetts Street in Lawrence looking north from what now is called 8th Street. A lot of people who visited Lawrence have visited Mass Street and would know the scene. In the street is a group of people, mostly men, dressed up in what look like heavy coats and long leather boots. They seem to be standing around and talking. It's not that orderly a place at the time. There's boxes and casks and things sitting in the street, and there are cattle wandering in the middle of Massachusetts Street. On the other side are a lot of wood frame buildings. When you look at this scene, you know that at some point William Clark Quantrill and his bushwhacker raiders are going to come over from Missouri and kill 150 folks, but also burn most of those buildings you're looking at in the scene. That, if this scene, we believe, was from 1863, if it was indeed from that year, then it was only months later, in August of that year, that downtown was left in a smoking ruin because of Quantrill's raid. To stand there today and look at that scene, to know that a lot of those buildings have been replaced, sometimes more than once, by the modern Massachusetts Street, is still to take a little bit of a trip through time. You're still standing there saying, gosh, now I've read about Quantrill all my life. Now I can see what it was he cut down.
Interesting. Now, you have a striking picture of Minnesota Avenue in Kansas City, Kansas. And wow, back then it was bustling and full of people and cars and traffic. And then the Today photo is a stark contrast.
It is. In the late 1960s, there was an effort made to put in a mall in downtown Kansas City, Kansas, along Minnesota Avenue, and it was considered pretty much a failure. It made traffic wind in and out. It made little sculptures and mounds on the street, but merchants departed. Now, downtowns across America were losing merchants and population in the 1960s, and so there were other causes for this, but apparently this mall did not help. The mall has been removed nowadays, but Kansas City, Kansas, that part of downtown has still not revived to the extent it did before. In the 1950s, it showed a streetscape of shops and stores and all kinds of places. You could do most of your shopping right there along Minnesota Avenue, and it's not true today.
Now, in Garnett, you have a then picture of a tornado that was shot by an old-fashioned camera.
Old-fashioned in the sense that it had to be on a tripod, old-fashioned in the sense that it was a wet plate negative, probably, that the photographer had to set up and get down behind his little cloak and move the plate and do all this while a tornado's going by. This was in 1884. It is, to everybody's knowledge, that right now, the first photo ever taken of a tornado in action. Now, today, every time there's a tornado anywhere, there are cell phones and digital video cameras and tornado chasers out. You get to see a tornado nowadays. It's no big deal to have seen the tornado headed toward or past a town. But in 1884, it was a really big deal. This tornado moved across near Garnett, but it didn't go through Garnett. So this photographer named Adams was able to go out on the street, set up his old bulky camera, and take what was the first photograph of a tornado in anywhere in the country.
Another one that we talked about was in Hayes, Kansas, which was smack in the middle of the Wild Wild West. Tell me about the picture of Cy Goddard's Saloon and Dance Hall.
There are two soldiers from nearby Fort Hays lying dead on the wooden sidewalk in this picture of the saloon. Now, many of us, especially when we were kids, would visit Wild West mock-up towns where there would be mock battles. The cowboy actors would fire blanks at one another. And we've seen movies where there's gunshots and people supposedly dying. But in all those cases, the actors got up and walked away and went on to another role later. In this case, these two soldiers were indeed dead. It was a Wild West shootout. They'd gotten into a fight with somebody inside Cy Goddard's saloon, and there they were, shot dead, lying in the wooden sidewalk outside. Interesting in this picture is that there's a small boy leaning against a corner of the saloon, sort of staring at them almost wistfully. The same scene today. There's a brick telephone company building there. The sidewalk is concrete. Yeah, there's a plaque over there that says this incident happened, but you would never in a million years guess this was the kind of thing you used to see in movies and TV.
Yeah, I think people don't realize when they see the TV versions that this was really real back then.
Mm-hmm. People really died, and that was real bloodshed.
It's striking that there are some buildings in Kansas that look exactly the way they did back then. I must say they're well built. The Cottonwood Falls Chase County Courthouse. And is that the oldest courthouse that's still standing?
It's the oldest courthouse that I believe that's still standing. It's definitely the oldest one that's been in continuous use as a courthouse for all those years. The early 1870s it was built. It's a landmark in Cottonwood Falls. It's beautifully arranged at the end of a long street, which you can come up and see this thing rising there, ornate Second Empire-style courthouse that looks today. It is one of those pictures where the now is not very much different at all from the then, and it still does the same thing inside. That's rare.
Now, what else is on your list of interesting photos from this book?
I can't pass by without mentioning that there were more than just European-American settlers headed west. There were African-American settlers. In the late 1870s, a group of black people from Kentucky were lured to the west by their – they knew what they were doing. The land dealers, speculators, had told them there would be land for them in northwest Kansas, in a little area in a county called Graham County. And so these people, many of them former slaves, immigrated to this spot in Graham County. They were a little surprised when they arrived to find not a single building and hardly a single tree there. They survived the first winter in the little town they named Nicodemus in dugouts, essentially, just basically living off the land and off what food they could get from nearby towns, if there were any, or farmers. They survived that winter, and they began to build a town which was called Nicodemus, which became an exoduster community in northwest Kansas. Their grand
now, when
hope,
you say exoduster community, talk about that for people who may not know what that is.
The exodusters were black people, most of them former slaves from the South, who even when slavery ended realized that life wasn't going to get that much better. There were segregation laws, and the Southern politicians didn't accept people for voting, and all the reasons we know about of late 19th century. People doing that. And so in groups, they moved to the north, some to Kansas City, Kansas, some to Kansas City, Missouri, and some went farther west. And the idea was that there was a great exodus from the south. And when they came to places like Kansas, they found lots of dust. So exodusters probably is the derivation of that term. The town of Nicodemus thrived for a while. Like every town that was built in Kansas, the fondest hope was that the railroad would come through, bring supplies, carry out materials they'd make, give people transportation. But like way too many towns in Kansas that are now ghost towns, the railroad bypassed Nicodemus. Happened a lot of places. And so Nicodemus never had the kind of growth it hoped for. Between the railroad bypassing it in the late 19th century and the Great Depression of the 1930s, the population of Nicodemus dwindled. In our Then and Now book, we show a photo taken by a photographer for the Kansas City Times in the mid-1960s. He and a reporter had gone to do a report on Nicodemus. The photo shows an elderly gentleman named Jerry Scruggs walking along the street right in front of the Masonic Hall, what had been the Masonic Hall and what had been an old store. Jerry Scruggs was 1 year old when that first group of 300 people moved west from Kentucky. He's gone now. So is the Masonic Hall. So is the grocery store. There are a few buildings remaining in Nicodemus, but it has been named a National Historic Site. The Recreation Hall, built in the 1930s, is a museum, which my wife and I went through, Jean and I went through as we did this this book, and it's fascinating. In the last, toward the end of July every year, there's a community celebration in Nicodemus where a lot of people, former residents and descendants of them, come back to celebrate the city of Nicodemus.
So really, your project took you all across the prairies and the plains. What stood out to you just generally as you captured pictures from the present and the past?
What stood out to me was you can't tell Kansas by just driving across it. There's many a town you can race past in a car, and you think, oh, that town only amounts to a couple of gas stations. But then you go into the original town itself, and you find real people in the town beyond the attendance of the gas stations out on the turnpike or the freeway or the two-lane highway. And you suddenly realize there's real people, and you know what? These people are pretty nice. They're very helpful. I like these guys.
Yeah, you point out that because Kansas is such a big state, most people's view of it is in a car window going on Interstate 77, going 75 miles an hour. So they're missing a lot, eh?
That's right. And I am guilty of, for decades, having missed a lot on my way zooming to Colorado or zooming to the south or zooming somewhere and not stopping to pay attention.
Monroe Dodd, thank you for being with us on KC Currents.
Thank you.
Monroe Dodd is the author of the book Kansas Then and Now. He also hosts a history show here on KCUR on Central Standard Fridays. You can see a slideshow of some of the photos he talked about in this interview. Go to the KC Currents page of our website at kcur.org.
We want to thank you for tuning in to KC Currents. This show will be archived along with all of our past shows on the KC Currents page at kcur.org.
You can also hear individual stories there or sign up for our podcast or find us on iTunes. Contact us at kccurrents@kcur.org or on Twitter at kccurrents.
KC Currents is produced by Suzanne Hogan and Alex Smith. Our senior producer is Sylvia Maria Gross. Zach Lewandowski is our intern, and our theme music is by Approach. And of course, I'm Susan Wilson.
And I'm Suzanne Hogan.